What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
A ho-ho holiday stack. I'm Justin.
And comics don't stop for Christmas. They are your present under the tree this year. Comics are still coming out, weirdly, on December 25th. Some stores, just if you're wondering, may not be open. Some publishers are sending them out on the 26th. So it's possible it's absolute chaos over at the comic book shop. So, you know, this may be spoilers for something that you may not get a day, 2 days, 3 days from now. Whatever it is, it's all good.
Is that a Christmas miracle, Alex?
Spoilers? I think so. Spoilers. Hey, spoilers. That's actually, I left that for my kids under the tree. It's just a big pile of spoilers.
It's and if you're bad. Like, if you're bad, you get spoilers in your stocking.
Yes. Their first question was, I thought we were Jewish, but I don't have an answer for that. Why don't we get into the comic books, kicking it off with, here we go. Okay, Time Slide, number one from Marvel Comics, written by Steve Fox, art by Ivan Fiorelli. This is Marvel's annual look ahead at what's coming in the year to come via a story. And in this case, you got Cable and Bishop tasked by Tempest to take down a new villain who is eating significant moments in time in the Marvel Universe, specifically X-Men continuity stuff, but as we find out later on, it's a bunch of other things as well. And they use it as an opportunity to sneak in little teasers of, whoa, time is broken. Oh, man, look at this. Here's a panel from this thing.
It's very funny that anytime we get an issue like this from Marvel or DC, there are two constants. One, time's broken. Guess what? Yep. Time's fucked up again. I'm like, what? Time's fine, guys. It's you're the ones who are being weird. And there's always a page that has a random list of random words that are clues for the future. Yes. I don't know why it always has to be a list. This one was front and center.
No, this does all of it. It does all of it. Yeah. They have two pages, maybe three pages, where it's like, whoa, look at these crystals of time of paddles that we drew. And one of them, which is very funny to me, there's a page where Bishop's like, what's going on here? This is terrible. One of the paddles is just like She-Hulk.
Like, there's She-Hulk nothing weird about smiling it. Smiling in the corner. Yeah, I have it here. Exactly. One of them is just like Deadpool. Another one is Saber. Is the Age of Apocalypse Sabretooth? That was interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are just like headshots of people that were like, uh-huh. Yes. Oh, Wolverine? Yeah, cool. What are the odds? He's part of the future?
And then, later on when we already gave the spoiler warning, so I won't keep doing it. But later on when they jump to the future, they meet Bronze from Exceptional X-Men All Grown Up. There's been a age of, what's Cypher's terrible name now? Not Devastation. Revelation? Something like that?
You don't know? Alex? It's Revelation, yes.
Sure. Anyway, they're doing like probably they're leading up to an Age of Revelation event. And she does exactly what you're saying. She's like, I made a list of all the things we need to stop. And the first one is like deaths of Spider-Man. And you're like, okay. And the next one is One World Under Doom. We're like, that's literally the title of the event.
Soon.
And then everything else leading up to like X versus X, where the X-Men are going to fight the X-Men and whatever.
Well, and we are already getting that happening in the current, this stack, we're going to talk about that very thing. So, well, the future is, well, is already
but here. Here's the thing that I'll say is like all of this is fine, but it's actually a fun story. Like I like Cable and Bishop teaming up with each other. It dives into the differences with the characters. They're two characters that are like, well, I hate you, but we got both got big guns and time travel, so let's go. So I had a good time reading this, and then whatever they were like, look at the future and ground to a halt. But then it kept going, and it was an enjoyable story regardless.
I agree. The specificity of having them be the focus here and then just getting a little bit of the time tease I thought was cool. When we got Revelation being like the highlighted villain, I was like, that can't be. Is it? It is. It's Cypher's weird apocalypse cosplay character. You want me to read the rest of the nonsense things on the list?
Sure. I mean, most of them do seem to be teasing very specific things. I don't know if you want to go through and I could give like commentary on what I think it's going to happen there.
They're pretty big. Sure. Like eight deaths, One World Under Doom, Rise of the New Champions, also already happening. Coming up in a couple months. The Eternal Storm. I think that's probably Storm.
That's issue 4 or 5. I think it's issue 5 of Storm. She becomes the Eternal Storm and she's like mediating a dispute between Eternity and Oblivion. So, yes, that is very clear.
Continuing a theme we've talked about a lot, in Marvel, the false metal, where metals are so important to the Marvel universe. New ones, old
ones.
Yeah,
I guess that's probably the Wolverine storyline that's going on right now, right?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. It could be. Iron Man's been talking about Mysterium so much, like maybe that it's over there. I feel like it could be a Vibranium thing, maybe a Black Panther. I don't know. So we'll see about that. Who waits within the last egg?
So that was, there's a little panel. This was the most interesting one to me. There's a little panel in the Time is Broken page of, I want to say it's Hope Summers, Elixir, and Proteus, three of the five standing over an egg. So I like this idea that like there's one leftover egg for the Krakoa era. Who's inside? Who's going to come out? We shall see.
I agree. These are the kind of teases I think work best, where it's not teasing an event. It's teasing a moment or an idea. Because that's the most engaging to me, because I can actually picture it. Strange of Asgard, Doctor Strange probably. Galactic Leaders
that's
assassinated.
Literally, there's a title called Doctor Strange of Asgard that's coming up. Yeah.
Makes sense. This is honestly, it's less teases. This is like a publishing list for like 3 months from now. The Time of Strife, I was psyched about that.
But it's not Strife with a Y, right?
Right.
It's Strife with an I.
Yeah.
But our boy, our sharp, sharp, beautiful little boy needs to come
our
back.
Sharpest boy. I got to think even it's with an I, it has to be that Strife. Why would they do that? Dormammu, Invasion of Earth.
That's not even the title of anything. That's
that's just.
Here's a plot summary.
This is her laundry list. Ms. Marvel's Second Genesis. Ultimate
so
incursion.
This one, well, the Miss Marvel said Second Genesis was interesting too, because earlier in the book they have this weird moment where they're like, well, what's Miss Marvel doing with the X-Men during Dark Phoenix
past,
and you're supposed to think it's like time is broken, so things are getting mixed around, but I think we're actually going to see that. Like, I bet we're going to have some sort of she gets trapped in important moments in X-Men history leading up to her actually getting her mutant light powers, something like that.
That's interesting. I was also thinking it could be, I feel like we're getting to a potential Dark Phoenix in current continuity as well. Mm, the way that Phoenix is in space, having the Phoenix powers. I was like, we're right there on the precipice. So maybe it's that. Ultimate Incursion makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's, they've been teasing that there is a summer event coming. That's what, that's the title of it.
Huge question. Yeah, definitely. Big question here. Who's the man with a hammer? Probably Thor.
Yeah, probably.
Could be Thor.
Guy who works at a hardware store?
Yeah, maybe. Carpenter you hired to do some work.
Maybe that's
apartment.
Just like a question they were asking. Like it came up in an editorial sheet. They're like, hey, who's that man with the hammer? And they're like, oh, that's the...
The Ghost Fist walks. I'm just going to read the rest of these and we can, if you have any more insight.
Yeah,
where
sure.
is Spider-Man? What becomes of Emily, her hands covering the second word?
That is Emily Bright, who is a character from Strange Academy, who we last saw her stepping into a portal and disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
So where is
she? The Will of Doom. Utgard rises.
That's Mortal Thor, for sure.
The Will of Doom, does that mean he dies?
I bet you're supposed to think it's like, ooh, the strong will of Doom. But he dies at the end of One World under Doom. And
that's what I think.
What did he leave to the world?
That's cool. And that's a cool idea. That's another one I'm like, that's intriguing to me. Age of Revelation shouts, Cypher's back with a bang. Beware the spider, Cable's head is blocking that one. Who would trade away immortality, XVX, and 3K Gene Bomb?
So the 3K Gene Bomb, that's the storyline in X-Men right now, is what I think they're leading up to. So, there's a bunch of stuff going on there. I think you also missed, wasn't there like assassination of alien leaders or something like that? Which again,
Galactic Leaders assassinated. I said that earlier, but that's a weird headline.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, that's a lot of stuff coming up, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this book. But point is, if you want a fun Cable Bishop story, check this out. If you want to see what's coming up in the Marvel Universe and get some headlines and other assorted silliness, not necessarily the focus here, but fun times.
You can put that list on your wall and cross it off slowly over the next several years, and so certainly some of them will not happen.
Metamorpho, the Element Man, number one from DC Comics, written by Al Ewing, art by Steve Lieber. This is bringing back Metamorpho and a supporting cast in, I want to say, a straightforward way. It's goofy, it's quirky, but it really is like straight out of 1960s comics. It's not what I thought going in, which was Al Ewing doing like a meta tweak on it. It's him doing like across the board, you know, like down to the narration, Steve Lieber's structure, etc.
Thought bubbles,
and very fun, very weird, great art, good writing, good times.
It is fun. It's something where I thought we were going to move past it at some point in this issue and get to a more modern feeling comic, but they do not. And I think it's so interesting with Metamorpho being in Superman that they're like, let's get some new readers. And they're like, let's do a very weird take on this character that's about to be more popular. But for me, a diehard comic reader, I was like, this is fun. This is wild. It feels like classic DC Sunday comics, but in larger form. And Al Ewing is the perfect writer for this. And Steve Lieber's perfect art as well.
For sure. Void Rivals, number 15 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Lorenzo DeFelici. In this issue, still a bunch of stuff going on with our cast in various places. We have one of the Void Rivals is heading deep below the surface of the planet to find something. I don't even think she knows what. Meanwhile, the other guy's hanging out with a bunch of Transformers, Hot Rod and Green One. And
Springer, I think. Jerry Springer.
Springer, yes. Yes, Jerry
Springer. I think
his
name is Jerry Springer.
Oh, okay. They all have first names, right? I think so.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this today again.
Jennifer Bumblebee.
Yeah. Hey, Brock Hot Rod here to... Well, that's the thing is like these guys who happen to be cars, then we're able to move past that from a premise. But the fact that they are named English words that are also cars, I'm like, hi, I'm Hot Rod. In my planet, that means that's like being named Bruce. But what does Hot Rod mean to you? Oh, a fast car?
I went to elementary school with like five other Hot Rods. It was so confusing. I was Large Hot Rod. That's what they called me.
Yeah. I was Ugly Rod. No one cared about me. We're in a middle. We're in a big middle in Void Rivals where like there's just, we're checking in. This feels like very much like sort of middle period Invincible to compare our writer's other work. Where it's just like we're checking on a lot of things and a lot of things are slowly being pushed forward to some eventual big fight or conflagration.
The most interesting thing to me in this book right now is not even the Void Rivals or anything else. It's the folks in Cobra Law who are just floating along in their weird squid ship. And one of them got hit with something and Pythonna is like, hey, keep an eye on her shoulder. Her shoulder's weird.
Yeah, her shoulder's got weird bumps. I was like, what?
I don't know, but it's so weird. I'm intrigued about what's going on there. And then Saxoid shows up, my favorite character world, with this enormous ship. And he's like, ha-ha, this is going to be great for my wife and
my
kids.
Family. I was like, what is the story here?
I don't know. But it makes me laugh out loud every single time I see him. It's so bizarre.
He's just in love.
Hellhunters, number one from Marvel, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Adam Gorham. This is spinning out of the introduction of the World War II Ghost Rider in Philip Kennedy Johnson's Incredible Hulk run. And here we're going back in time to see his origin. He mixes up a little bit with Nick Fury and some other folks, and there's the promise that Wolverine is coming down the pike. You generally love Philip Kennedy Johnson's work, as do we all. But Justin, what did you think of this?
Yeah, no, I really like this as well. What I love here is Philip Kennedy Johnson knows he's great at entering stories. And in this, we come in on the villains. We establish them first, which I thought was really surprising and cool. And then only later do we come around and meet our World War II Ghost Rider. And then he connects with some other big-time Marvel characters. But great tone. Philip Kennedy Johnson, famously in the military, so I think he has a real understanding and knack for writing military characters, which we get a ton of here. The art is nice from Adam Gorham. In time period, feels a little bit like a classic comic, but with a good modern take on it. I thought this was great. I'm going to pick this up.
Yeah, I agree with that all. I was going to call out Adam Gorham's art in particular. It's very dark and sort of like scratchy lines, which really emphasize the darkness of the story, which I thought was really nice. So like this one quite a bit. Excited to see where it goes. Next up, let's talk about one of my absolute favorite issues of the week. Absolute Wonder Woman, number 3 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Hayden Sherman. I want to, even though I did the spoiler warning several times at the beginning, I definitely want to put a spoiler warning here because I feel like we need to talk about the big thing that happened in the issue. But another fantastically, deeply emotional issue, the way that Kelly Thompson is writing this character, particularly her relationship with Steve Trevor. She is fighting a giant monster called the Tetracide, who can kill you in 4 different ways. And she's trying to stop it, even though she knows that she can't. She's trying to get as many people to safety as possible. We also meet Barbara Minerva, who we know in the future potentially is going to be Cheetah at some point here. And there's a fair amount of chemistry, I would say, between Diana and Barbara, as well as Diana and Steve in a very different way. But big thing I want to talk about, every single issue of this has had a moment that has just made my jaw drop. The first issue, that montage of her growing up that Hayden Sherman put together, was absolutely stunning. Second issue, just the pure introduction of Steve Trevor coming out of the fog, was absolutely beautiful. And here, what we find out is that Wonder Woman sacrificed her arm to free Steve Trevor from hell. We get that information in the past in the flashback, and in the present, it doesn't slow her down at all. She is dealing with limb loss. She straps on a new metal arm and gets right back into the fight. And beyond like, oh, wow, she doesn't have an arm, and oh, God, what a horrifying moment to see this happen. It, in a sort of very outside the comic book way, it really just struck me to have a Wonder Woman who has limb loss and keeps going and keep fighting. Just thinking about, there's going to be people in the audience, young girls, young boys, whoever, who see that, and that is going to mean so much to them. I just thought this was a phenomenal comic that also has a really wonderful real-world impact at the same time.
Yeah, and then from inside the story, the idea that this Wonder Woman, you know, grew up in hell, and like then is just sacrifice feels like more of just an everyday thing for her. We get that in the story as well, as she faces the Tetracide, and it's basically like, I'll go try and stop this thing, but this thing will kill everyone. I'm going to do my best, and if I die, so be it. So like, the sacrifice was just such the watchword here. But man, this Hayden Sherman art, we talked in our best comics of 2024 about the Absolute comics are great. We lumped them together, and I don't know, now I feel like we need to separate them out because this comic is so good. I think all of these Absolute comics are great in different ways, but man, this one just, I feel like every issue I dip my face into a new world, and the Hayden Sherman art just takes you there. There's so many great moments, just panels. There's a moment where once she has her robot hand on, she just like delicately touches Steve Trevor's cheek, and it's just like such a good moment. I also love this line. They're like, hey, what happened to your arm? She's like, I lost my arm a long time ago. In its place is a magic arm my mother and I made. I can get it back, but it will take complicated magic. But she's basically like, she's running. She's like, shut up. That's stupid. I have to go kill this thing. It's just so great.
The thing that the last thing I'll say about this, that I'm so impressed about this book in particular, is it's taking place so far over a very small span of time. Wonder Woman has showed up, started fighting these monsters, and she's like, go, 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 go. Come on, we have no time here. We got to go. It's essentially, I don't even know if a day has necessarily passed in real time. And certainly we're getting the flashbacks, but it doesn't feel deconstructed. It feels like a rich meal in every issue. And the way that Kelly Thompson is writing it, it does tell a complete story in every issue as well. This is phenomenal. So good. Geiger, number 9 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Paul Pelletier and Gary Frank. In this issue, Geiger and his helpful squire are at a safe haven in the radioactive wasteland, or at least they thought, until some of the kings and whatevers from Las Vegas attack them. Justin, curious to hear what you think about this, because I know you've been very back and forth about this title. I don't know.
I'm back. I don't know which one is the negative one, back or forth. But
I'm honestly not sure either.
Yeah, but I'm so back and forth. But I thought this was the best issue of the series. And this, and a comic we're going to talk about in a little bit, feels like this Ghost Machine universe is starting to take shape in a way that I like, where it feels like there are touch points between the characters that feel meaningful. And we're now that we've established a lot of their just their premise and their emotional sort of place, like it, that we can actually use it and move forward. And I thought this issue was really good for Geiger in general.
I agree. He starts to go hog wild because of the radioactivity, and it gives him a new emotional layer. Plus, there's obviously a lot of like very intense action that comes off of that at the same time. The one quibble I've had, which made me think of you, Justin, is there's a moment when somebody asks him something. He's like, you know, my wife and kids died.
We made fun of this comic for launching like 9 times before it actually started, or I did. I should speak for myself. And in this, moment you're highlighting, he literally recounts his origin again. I wanted the whole group of townspeople to be like, "We know, dude. You talk about it constantly."
Anyway, otherwise, great art in here. I think I said this with the last issue, but Paul Pelletier is a great fit for this. And we have a not-so-surprising return since we know it's coming at the end here, drawn by Cary Frank. But good to see him on the title as well.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sabretooth, The Dead Don't Talk, number one for Marvel, written by Frank Thierry, art by Michael Sta-Maria. Sabretooth is dead in current continuity, and Wolverine is having a drink to lament slash celebrate that when he sees a picture of Sabretooth in a situation he never knew he was in from back in the day in the bar. And that gives us a story slash flashback of what was going on with Sabretooth. And it seems like, and I say this not dismissively, essentially Frank Thierry's chance to do Gangs of New York, except with Sabretooth in the middle there. Great.
Definitely. Reading this, I could almost hear Frank pitching it. I could be like, he's like, no, here's what happens. Wolverine's in a bar. There's a fucked up picture behind the bar. That's my Frank Thierry impression. But I did like, I don't know why Wolverine's just such a dick all the time. Like, he's finally relaxing in a bar. The guy's trying to be nice to him, and Wolverine's like such a maniac to him. I want more of that scene. But I do think this Gang of New York Sabretooth mashup is a fun world to be in.
Yeah. And art's good as well. This is a fun one. Excited to follow it. Black Canary, Best of the Best, number two from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Ryan Sook. In this issue, we're continuing the fight between Lady Shiva and Black Canary to see who's the best hand-to-hand fighter in the world. And meanwhile, in the flashback section, Black Canary is training with her mom, and we get a lot more of the emotional underpinnings of this fight and exactly what's going on here. Justin, what did you think about this one?
Another great issue. I mean, this book, I'm trying to figure out, you know, Tom King is a coy with information in a lot of his titles like this, but strong on theme at the top. And so I feel like the theme here is like intergenerational sacrifice, and the way that like our parents shape who we as kids become. And this is all about Black Canary's mom, who was also Black Canary, how she basically pounded her into shape to become a superhero. And we just get some beautifully drawn Ryan Sook scene work with those flashbacks. Ryan Sook, also an artist I've loved forever. The style is just different here. It's like, it's more lifelike. Ryan Sook, I feel like, does a lot of sort of stylized, almost Mike Mignola-esque stuff in the past that I really enjoy. And this is like different. So like, that's really wild to see. And Tom King is having fun with the boxing announcers in this as well.
Yes, the boxing announcers may be a little much for me. Like,
They talk a lot.
But the fight scenes by Ryan Sook, there's a palpable, like, meat-on-meat feel that comes from them that you don't feel from most superhero fight scenes that are a little lighter and a little more posy. Like, it's very visceral when you're reading it. But the biggest thing to me is spoiled on the cover here, or just on the cover here, is this thematic thing that Tom King plays with of Black Canary wears a wig. She wears a blonde wig. Her mother wears a blonde wig when she goes out and does her vigilante thing. And then, here's the spoiler part, at the end, although we kind of, I think, knew this for the first issue, she has cancer and she's dying. So she takes off the wig, she's been in chemotherapy, she's bald, so...
Her mom, just to be clear.
Her mom, yes, yeah, exactly. So we're getting this sense of, like, putting on the wig turns you into Black Canary, so what is it when she takes off the wig? It's something that I think they're going to play with more as they go forward, but I actually think this is one of the most straightforward things that Tom King has done in a very long time. It really is what it is on the surface, and then you get these little twists at the end in terms of emotionally why Dinah is doing this.
There's a little bit of comedy in here as well when they're talking about Green Arrow, like, he keeps dying. He's dead. Is he alive again? I don't know. I have an alert on my phone for when he's declared dead. I thought that was a fun little beat. Yeah.
Violent Flowers, number 4 from Image Comics by Maria Lovett. This is the final issue of this mini-series about some vampires. There's a vampire mystery. They're trying to solve the mystery. The vampires get older and then younger. It's mostly, I think, a chance for Maria Lovett to flex her art muscles once again. There's some good action in this issue, great character drawing. What'd you think about this one, Justin?
Yeah, this is the end, but I don't know exactly what happened or what will continue to happen. In the back, Maria Lovett talks about how there's more stories in this world. I was like, I know there are. I feel like there's the end to this story somewhere in this world that I haven't experienced yet. But yes, the art is great in this, and you can see on the cover, if you like that, there's a lot more beautiful work like that within.
Kidpool Spider-Boy, number 1 from Marvel, written by Christopher Yost, art by Nathan Stockman, Jed Doherty, and Chris Campagna. This is taking the Kidpool from Deadpool and Wolverine, the movie, bringing her into the Marvel Universe, mixing her up with Spider-Boy, as well as Deadpool and Spider-Man and a bunch of other characters as well. I'll tell you what, not my favorite things of the world, meaning like Deadpool, Spider-Man, Spider-Boy, etc. But this won me over by the end, just in terms of pounding into the jokes and pounding into the ridiculousness of the situation. To spoil the villain here, the villain is a woman who just really wants to marry a dinosaur, and it follows that path pretty hard to the end. So, I don't know, made me giggle, made me laugh a couple of times. I enjoyed a bunch of the bits. And that's pretty much what that is here for.
Well, and I think this issue, this comic, fights above its weight, I think is the cliche to say here, in that bats above its average. You know what I'm talking about, Alex?
Sure. Yeah.
Punches above the belt.
Puts in an extra tablespoon of flour in the recipe.
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, when I know I love something when there's more flour in it. You know, give me some of that.
You
got to
try my famous flour cookies.
Yes.
I use flour instead of chips, instead of chocolate chips.
Chocolate chips or potato chips? Alex is a bit of a manic baker. So just
here's
be
the
careful.
Thing. The thing about baking that I love is you can do whatever. You don't have to follow the recipe.
That's actually the one rule you are supposed to follow is do the recipe. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say here is the structure of this book is really smartly laid out. We ride with Kidpool first as the narrator, and then it flips at a point to Spider-Boy. They're talking about romance. Then the story flips into a bit of a romance with the villains. There's some like flirtation between Kidpool and Spider-Boy that is being played out here. And it just has the whole book sort of rhymes with each other thematically and structurally. And I thought that was a pleasant surprise.
Batman, The Long Halloween, The Last Halloween, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Loeb, art by Cliff Chiang. Here, Batman is recovering. Well, he gets severely injured in this issue and is lying in a coma, I guess, for most of the time, while Robin desperately tries to save him. I think this is probably my favorite issue of this so far.
Same. By far, I thought.
Yeah, and the crazy part is it gets away from whatever the central mystery is for the most part, and instead is just this really beautiful look at how the various characters interact. Batman, Robin, Alfred in particular gets a great moment in the sun here. There's multiple moments, the way that Cliff Chiang lays it out, that like really got me. There's the panel, I think it's Batman talking to Robin down the staircase and Alfred is there listening to him around the corner, that really like gave me a hitch in my heart. Plus there's some great Catwoman stuff in here. Awesome issue.
Yeah. I mean, they never use the word coma. But Batman's just out for a week. And I don't know, is that when a coma starts? Is after a week for a Batman type? He's so
for
hurt.
For a Batman type?
For like a Batman. Not a real life coma. I think that's more medically diagnosable. But they're literally like doing chores around the Batcave. And they're like, how is he? And Alfred's like, it's up to him. I was like, what? That's not how medicine works.
Yeah.
But it does set up a great moment at the end of the comic that I thought was very cool and paid off the whole thing. And yeah, like you're saying, just great character moments. Robin really stepping up in a cool way. We're using a lot of trapeze metaphor, which we've seen a ton of times before when we're having Dick narrate something, but it's used well here, I thought. There's a couple of great little moments.
And Cliff gives a interview in the back. They've been doing these really nice little interviews with the artists in the back of every issue, and he talks about how he was specifically told, you don't need to copy what Tim Sale was doing. Do your own thing and try to get the spirit there. And he nails it. Like this, I don't know. I do not have the words to express it, but I love Cliff Chiang's art and everything. So it's wonderful to see his style here. But it really does feel like the pacing, the tone, and the angling that you would get from a Tim Sale book at the same time. So it's just a wonderful melding of the two styles.
Yeah, and the villain reveal at the end is set up for next issue. We have Bill Sienkiewicz coming in with Dave Stewart, and that's going to be sick.
Yeah. Red Coat, number 8 from Ghost Machine at Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Brian Hitch. This is not exactly a one-shot because we get some teases for other storylines throughout here, but it's basically like a nasty little horror story about a family who kills and robs people and how our titular Red Coat ends up in the middle. I thought this was great, like another good issue in a row. I was very surprised and impressed.
Same. Like, this is so good. I feel like Red Coat's my favorite comic out of Ghost Machine now. I thought this was great, and I hope that this, you know, when we talked to Jeff Johns about this like a few weeks ago, he was saying that, you know, he wants this to sort of go and be its own thing a little bit. This is like the Shaggy Dog of the Ghost Machine universe. With the issue we had last month, I think, was the Albert Einstein issue that was like, you know, how did we get here? Where Albert Einstein is this like best friend to an immortal Red Coat. And this, like, if the comic can keep just doing this, it's going to be surprising every issue. And that's great.
Yeah. Plus some always great Brian Hitch art, some good action scenes, and some really gross horror stuff going on, too. West Coast Avengers, number 2 from Marvel, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Danny Kim. In this issue, Firestar finally arrives on the West Coast. Meanwhile, the team's mostly kind of hanging out and doing some stuff.
Yeah, this comic.
Yeah, go
you
ahead.
You go. I feel like we're about to say similar things.
No. I think we are going to say the same thing, which, like, I want to like this because I like this cast, but barely anything is happening in here, and not even in like a setting up characters way, so much as the amount of story we've gotten through by the end of issue 2 feels like the amount of story maybe we should have gotten through by like page 10 of issue 1 or something like that. There's not to borrow what you just said, but a little bit of a shagginess going on here in terms of the storytelling. Everybody seems very ambivalent about what they're doing, and not to backseat edit, but I think we talked about this with issue 1 as well. There's a moment where Rhodey is talking to the head of the prison about Blue Bolt is the character who's the villain they're trying to reform, where he's like, the warden's like, got a bunch of other people here. He's like, we'll get to that. I was like, No, we should know about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It just doesn't, I don't know why the Blue Bolt is so like front and center. They're trying to make Blue Bolt a thing. And I'm like, tell us why. Like, I'm into it. It seems interesting, potentially. But the characters are just sort of hanging out. I like the way the issue started with the Spider-Woman action sequence was cool. But then it feels like it treads water for a lot of this. I don't know why Iron Man's in his other armor. It doesn't track with anything else. Firestar popping up, I thought was great. Gave it a little spark. But I want to see more of what's happening here. And then the end, the villain, this like Ultron that's starting a religious cult. I think that's cool too, but we just get a little tease of it. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's not all coming together. I want it to congeal like a beautiful eggnog.
Yeah, or like some sort of flour cookie.
Yes, exactly. My favorite things. Congealed eggnog and flour cookies.
Merry Christmas. Justice League Unlimited number 2 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid, art by Dan Mora. In this issue, we're picking up on one of the plot threads set up in the first issue with Batman and Blue Beetle down south dealing with a parademon infestation, and a bunch more of the Justice League shows up to help out with that, leading to a surprisingly involved parademon and a new status quo for Martian Manhunter. This maybe isn't as like knocking it out of the park as the first issue, mm-hmm. but it's just like such a solid team. Again, yeah. Like Mark Waid knows how to write all of these characters, balance all of these characters. Dan Mora can draw anything. This is just a really good, solid Justice League book.
Yeah, and I think we're setting up a bunch of stuff. It, you know, when Martian Manhunter like storms off and is like messed up, it's like, holy shit, he's the dork. He's the straight one. He's like, mm-hmm. Why is he so upset? There are a couple of great panels at the end of just Wonder Woman being like wide-eyed, like, what is happening with that guy? That I thought was really funny. The Dan Mora draws them really well. And yeah, there's a lot going on, and I like it, and I'm just going to keep writing. This feels – we gave the same sort of comment on Void Rivals, but this feels like there's just more juice behind it. So I appreciate that extra push.
Well, I think the difference between the two of them is Void Rivals feels like Game of Thrones style pocket checking in on a bunch of things.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily thematically connected. This is using essentially one big action sequence or one big stage setting to check in on all of these characters and push them in other directions. Like Mark Waid, and he always does this, he's looking at the game board, and he's like, okay, if I move this guy here, this is what this guy needs to move, and this is what they need to do. He's making connections. Like, there's a great little moment between Mary Marvel and Wonder Woman where they're like, Oh yeah, yes. We kind of worship the same gods. Okay, we're kind of connected to them, but one, they're Greek and Roman, and it's a little different. And okay, let's go from there. And it's great. It's just like this encyclopedia. He uses his brain encyclopedia to figure out how to make those fun moments there.
Yeah.
Speaking of fun moments, Violator number 4 from Image Comics, written by Mark Andreyko, art by Gianerico Bonacorsi. I'm so sorry for mangling your name there. Violating it, if you will. So in this issue, Violator continues to wander the world and finds a new skin suit in Rasputin, and then proceeds to work his way through the legend of Rasputin the way we know it. And I'll tell you what, probably my favorite issue of this so far. I feel like what were you going to say, Justin?
I was going to say, I have a lot of questions, but I agree. I really enjoyed reading this. I've never spent so much time hearing about Rasputin's giant hog as I have reading this comic. But great historical fact, I guess. It's definitely entered my canon, my head canon.
Yeah. The reason I think this worked so well versus we had a Dark Ages thing, I think, in the past issue. And my criticism of that was like there were a bunch of good ideas, but there were a bunch of good ideas. And it was Violator just jumping from thing to thing without necessarily following a concrete story. Using the legend of Rasputin, it's such a one-to-one fit with Rasputin, like famously a disgusting man who people were so attracted to. So literally sticking a demon in his skin fits so well, and it gives a overall structure there, because the story of Rasputin, again, has like a very tragic three-arc structure to it. So it's a very nice pocket there, and it feels like to me, I know they're not going to do this because they only have two more issues, but it feels like to me like, oh, you could do like young Indiana Jones Chronicles, but instead of Indiana Jones teaming up with famous good historical figures, Violator just like wearing the skin of famous bad historical figures. Yeah. Potentially very fun going forward.
I do have some questions about how the skin stuff works, because the way the comic is like, he puts it on like a pants and shirt, like a coverall situation. But He's also a big plot point here is that Violator's fucking a lot of people in Russia. I was like, oh yeah, is that what you're doing with that skin suit? But apparently, so there's a little bit of magic we're not quite getting here.
Yeah,
but shouts.
But there you go. X-Men number 9 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Federico Vigicini and Ryan Stegman. We're continuing the Raid on Gray Malkin crossover. When we last left the X-Men teams, they were fighting because their aggression had been amped up by the folks who run the prison. And that's kind of where we pick up this issue.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of action as they fight each other. Naturally, they do figure it out, and there's a neat little twist at the end of the issue.
Yeah, and the woman who runs the Gray Malkin prison, former mansion, ex-mansion, Karina Ellis, all she does all the time is walk around and be like, mutants are scumbags, right, everybody? And I'm just like, okay, we can do, even like people who are evil like that, they keep some of it in their heads a little bit.
Isn't she also a mutant? Like, I think she is a mutant, and she just keeps calling them gene trash over and over again.
Yeah, like, I'm like, you can turn it down a little bit, lady. Just, we know you hate them. You're trying to kill them constantly. I like, there's so much X fighting here, and that's cool. We've seen that in the past. We're going to see more of that. The more interesting part is the fact that Karina Ellis and the Gray Malkin team have turned some X-Men into villains, essentially, which I think is interesting, mm-hmm. but we don't know how or why that happened. So I want to know what that's about, if that's going to be an ongoing thing. And then we have an extended sequence where Rogue's like, hey, let's save Professor Xavier, you know, the man that plucked us out of our lives and saved us. And Cyclops is like, nope, he's bad. And I was like, what, dude? Get out. I tried to go to bat for you, dude. And that was just not a cool scene. And then the issue ends, slight spoiler, but we knew it was coming, where Professor X walks out and revealing that there's another crazier mutant hidden behind in the big jail cell. And I'm like, let's let Professor X be good. I just want him, like the ruined father figure that we've done with both Cyclops and Professor X. Let them just be good, I say.
Yeah, I'm enjoying moments in here, but like I said with the previous issues, this just feels like so soon. Like you're saying, I don't know enough about the jail. I don't know enough about the jailer. It seems very broad strokes, old school, like Bolivar Trask opens up a prison and he's like, I'm going to enslave all the mutants. And that's all I'm getting from her. I thought we were getting something different, and we're not necessarily. Plus, like you mentioned, just trying to come up with this Professor X Magneto ideological divide between Rogue and Cyclops by making Cyclops be like, I hate my dad now, is, I don't know, it just doesn't track for me.
Well, and plus then, I don't know what we're doing with Magneto is wheelchair bound. And I'm like, what are we just doing a switcheroo? Like, is that what it boils down to? I'm like, I don't know about that, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we'll get to what I am liking better in X-Men in a moment, so why don't we keep moving it along. Detective Comics 1092 from DC Comics, written by Tom Taylor, art by Mikel Janine. In this issue, Batman is dealing with a couple of things, including a mysterious new villain who is draining the blood from teenagers on the streets of Gotham. Meanwhile, he seems to be getting some sort of ingestion of young people's blood. And
well, we don't know if they're connected, Alex.
Okay,
we don't know that. We don't know that. It's a mystery.
No, that's true.
That's a mystery, a blood mystery, as we are teased on the cover.
Oh, and by the way, the company is called Sangreal, and he's like, he's figured out the Grail part. But
he's the world's greatest detective, Alex. Let him cook. Let him work a little bit. Let him work the case.
I'm sorry.
Boots on the ground.
I'm sorry. A podcaster, should not be able to get ahead of Batman in any scenario whatsoever.
He's investigating, and by that I mean wining, dining, and then taken to bed the woman who has invented this miracle cure at the same time that teenagers are being drained of their precious little blood. What it comes down to is Batman has a Gotham City of blood boys that he's sucking dry to be a little bit stronger.
What happened to the thing in the first issue of this run where they were like, Thomas Wayne actually saved Joe Chill. I was like, oh, that's interesting. How are we going to play that out? And so far, nope.
It Bruce wasn't that he was having, boys, a, he was having an affair. Yeah, he was having an affair. Wasn't that teased in the beginning?
Yeah, I think, yeah, that was teased as well.
He has
so
a brother.
There was this interesting, right, there was these interesting, the brother things happening over in Batman.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking.
But so they
that's
had
the affair.
Something
the
like
affair
that.
Is the affair is what led to the brother. So that must be right. Batman.
Yes. Anyway, point being, like, I thought it was really interesting how we were dealing with this twist in Batman's history, and I assume I trust Tim Taylor. We'll get back to it at some point. But like, that's way less interesting than this mystery that we are 15 steps ahead of Batman on. That's all.
Yes, agree. I do like Batman like dating a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. let's let
yep.
these people be people, and like that was cool.
All right. Hornsby and Halo, number two from Ghost Machine and Image Comics. Lots of Ghost Machine this week, written by Peter J. Tomasi, art by Peter Sneeberg. We're following two kids, one who is a devil kid who is sent to live with a good family, and the other is an angel kid sent to live with a bad family. How will that impact them? We don't quite know yet, but they are figuring out that they have angel and demon superpowers, and we're dealing with the ramifications of their first adventure in this issue. Justin, I think you were pretty high on the first issue of this. What do you think about the second one?
Well, it's fun. This is it. Like they are really Peter J. Tomasi is really using the premise here well, and introducing a lot of complicating factors that make it that get it beyond just a like what if good was raised by evil. Like it's beyond that nature versus nurture thing. The thing I want to point out that is wild is like literally everyone down to the family dog in their household, one of their households is like an evil thing or someone who's like speaking in tongues to be like, we're close to understanding the Hornsby and Halo issue. I'm like, what? Everything is out to get these kids. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to get to it a little bit more because I'm not quite sure how this book is going to work in the long term, but I really like the designs of the characters and there is a lot of fun to be had here. So definitely going to give it an issue or two more to keep checking it out. Amazing Spider-Man number 64 from Marvel, written by Justina Ireland, art by Gleb Melnikov. We're continuing to follow the eight deaths of Spider-Man that was teased.
Time slide.
Time
it's
slide.
Right there.
That's crazy that they got it out so quickly after time slide. Anyway, future. Spider-Man is following, waiting for the third fight in his fight against the Scions of Sidorak in order to save the world. He's died three times so far. Oh, so this is actually the fourth fight, but he's won three times as well. So he's starting to get a little cocky. Maybe he's not going to win this one. I guess we'll see. What'd you think about this, Justin? And just a shout out to your girl, Shay, who shows up and we get a new important piece of information about her, which is she's wondering if Peter Parker is busy all the time.
Great scene between her and Aunt May where just Shay and May, Shay on May on Shay, really getting into what Peter Parker's watch problems. Yeah, some of this stuff is a little bit like, okay, we know this. We don't need to revisit how annoying it is when someone's late. Has that ever happened to you, Alex? Listener, I was late to this very taping. I'm the Peter Parker of being on time. Thing about this is like I like some of the ideas here and the art's really nice, but these Scions are so cocky. Isn't the whole thing that they've been beaten every single year by Doctor Strange? And now they're like
every single cycle or however long it is,
whatever it is. And they're like, ha ha, I'm going to kill you. No problem. I'm like, you lose. You've only lost. How are you so confident in a win here?
I did like some of the magical battles, and I know I've said this with this storyline before, but I don't usually like magical Spider-Man. This part is working for me. There's a fun trick where he like calls out, I don't remember the exact spell, but he's like, Shades of Archaeus, and he's actually casting another spell, but he's calling out a Pokemon to trick the guy. Very fun. I don't know.
Yeah. Fun stuff. There's fun happening here, especially this coming off of the Zeb Wells run, which was there's a lot of heavier ideas and gang war, all of that. This feels like such a nice welcome departure from that stuff. I'm just curious what the status quo is going to be and if we can get beyond this expected, like, Peter Parker's not on time stuff that we've lived our lives with.
Yes. Speaking of not on time, or rather definitely on time, Superman number 21 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Dan Mora. After all the big stuff that happened to the previous issues with Doomsday and the Time Trapper, Superman's trying to take a little break and take Lois on a date, first on the moon and then to a couple of other places. But lurking in the background is the fact that something bad is coming down the road with Doomsday, with the Time Trapper, with General Zod down the road, and other things, and that's looming over their date. I thought this issue was great as well.
Agree.
So, I mean, there's romance to be had here, and there's some really fun cutaways to the rest of the extended cast that move them forward or not, either, you know, not in funny ways or definitely in interesting ways. There's a great scene with Mercy and Lex Luthor that got like a lot of heat with it, burned up the, right there in the comic book shop while I was reading it. But the general theme that he's working with, like that Superman and Lois, they work together at the Daily Planet. Now they're superheroes together. What do they talk about when they go on a date? Is like crazy relatable, I think, to most people probably reading this comic book. And he makes it work while still pushing them to another place, making it challenging for Superman emotionally. I think really smartly done. And I was really impressed.
I agree with all of that. And I really like the status quo here of this like Doomsday threat hanging over his head, and the thing that happens at the end of the issue really sort of exacerbates that in a great way. So like the threat is really nice, the relationship between Clark and Lois is great, and them both being superpowered is also really fun right now. Like I want more of this. I want this to keep going for a while. And just a shout out again, Dan Mora's art, he's just crushing it right now. This is such great art. This and the other book we talked about, man, it's good.
Next up, speaking of good art, Dust to Dust, number one from Image Comics, written by J.G. Jones and Phil Bram, art by J.G. Jones. Now, this book, this definitely shows you why you shouldn't judge a book by the cover, and certainly given it its Image comic book, they have this, like, disturbing-looking red goggles person, burning car, other things. And I went into this being like, oh, man. Here he comes, the red goggles guy. Man. This is going to be messed up, whatever the sci-fi or horror twist is. But nope, it's basically like Grapes of Wrath style.
It's just chill Steinbeck sad shit happening.
And it's well done, and it's gorgeously drawn by J.G. Jones. But I feel like I got to go back and read this one again, because the entire time I was like, okay, let's get to the twist.
There is a slow burn happening. It's a tense book to read, and you know, it's mostly like black and white, or sort of like amber and white.
Sepia toned?
Sepia, yes. And then we get little notes of color, and I think that really draws you in, makes it pop. I feel like this book itself feels like dusty, and like I think there's a lot of intention behind this title. So I was intrigued by it.
Yeah, I'm definitely intrigued now that I know what it is, and reading J.G. Jones's notes about like, I just wanted to write a really good Dust Bowl story. I was like, oh, okay. All right. There's not gonna be any aliens or a murderer at any point. Okay, let's keep reading. So I'm into that. I'm out to Rosa Sharn, you know. You know what I'm talking about?
Anyway.
Let's talk about the kind of X-Men comics I want to read, as I teased earlier. Exceptional X-Men number 4 from Marvel, written by Eve L. Ewing, art by Carmen Carnero. We are focusing on the Chicago X-Men as Kitty and Emma Frost try to train this new class of 3 kids who are just figuring out how to use their mutant abilities. We focus in on Bronze in this issue as she tries out for the school play. Meanwhile, Iceman is here, and Kitty is very suspicious about what's going on. Love this issue. Love that it was just like low stakes in terms of the world isn't ending or anything, but high stakes in terms of the character's emotions for Kitty, for Iceman, for Bronze. We get, you know, some fun, funny stuff with Emma Frost and the rest of the kids in here as well. This is great. I'm really, really enjoying this book.
Yeah, the book is taking its time with the storytelling in a way that I am enjoying. It doesn't feel slow. It feels like it's like, no, we're building towards something. We get some emotional peaks. We get a little mystery here. We get Kitty Pryde just being mean. She's just mad. all the time. Feels like that's something we're exploring here. I think this is fun.
Yeah. It's basically like a teen drama with X-Men versus a teen, like, there's no end of the world stakes. There's no big fights or anything like, well, there is one big fight in here, but it's good. Good comic books. The Flash, number 16 from DC Comics, written by Simon Spurrier, art by Vasco Georgiev. The Flash family is still on vacation in Skartaris, I believe.
Yes,
is
the secrets of Skartaris are being explored here.
There you go. And Weather Wizard is attacking this issue. Justin, you've been loving this, so take it away.
I love this Flash run. You know, this is a book that I think has been just excellent. Simon Spurrier has brought some new ideas to Flash. And in this comic, it hit me that one of the bigger ideas is that, like, adults, you know, make mistakes. We saw that a lot in the previous longer arc. And here it's like these adults are just – they're stuck in their ways a bit. Flash is just running fast, even when his powers are a little bit messed up. But the young people – are the ones bringing new ideas, and they're the ones trying to figure stuff out, and they're the ones that can move the story forward. And, like, it's such a subtle bit of maybe philosophy behind this take on Flash, but it really plays through while at the same time getting some, like, just great Simon Spurrier, wild ideas, bizarre world around these very well-known and understood main characters.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying this arc as well. It just seems very grounded and not grounded at all, but like very grounded in the family, like focusing on them. Like they even make a joke about it. The previous arc and being like, I thought we were done with all these crazy universe ending stakes and all that time weirdness and everything, but they still have a little bit and it creeps in. Very creative, very fun. Uncanny Valley, number 7 from Boom Studios, written by Tony Fleeks, art by Dave Wachter. In the previous issue, we zoomed back and got the whole history of the cartoon world. Now we're catching up with our main hero, who is finding himself in the cartoon world and learning more about the stakes and his destiny, while outside, his grandpa, who is also a cartoon, and his mom are really hashing
talking
it out.
Talking it up.
Having a hard talk.
This book is good. I want to highlight the Dave Wachter art, which again, like we interviewed these guys like earlier this year and talked about, we asked him like, hey man, how are you drawing both the hyper-realistic humans, the animated characters, and then somehow making it seamlessly connect without feeling super fake or gimmicky? And he just does it every issue. In this one, there's a lot of that, and that's hard, and he just nails it.
Yeah, this is a great-looking book. It's endlessly creative. Like we said, every issue, Tony Fleeks just knows how to be like, and now here's another detail about cartoons and how it affects them. There's some really fun bits in here involving like a well and how doors work and everything like that. So great stuff. Definitely pick up this book. Iron Man, number 3 from Marvel, written by Spencer Ackerman, art by Julius Ota and Jethro Morales. There is yet another attempt takeover of Stark Industries going on here, and this time it includes Hell itself coming for
Belasco.
Him. Belasco. What do you think about this book, Justin?
Well, I'll tell you what. I feel like this was set up as, like, we're going to get a bunch of corporate shenanigans. I was like, okay. I hear about that a lot in the real world. Don't love it there, so I don't know if I need to read about it in these comic books. But I like that we got far enough, fast enough into, like, this board meeting is in hell, and Iron Man was able to win, and we are moving now past the sort of having to take a board member vote as a main plot point for Iron Man. So that's exciting. This book is definitely in the, oh, let's have a metal named Mysterium that's really important. And I think we've talked a lot about being sort of over that as a thing. So I hope we're moving past that. But I like this, the end of this, and the way the status quo is now established for Iron Man a little bit more.
That's very generous of you to think the status quo is established, given that there have been 1 million things that have happened in every issue of this so far. And there's a level I appreciate writing an Iron Man book where it is like 5 million ideas going at every minute and just like grasping at different things and throwing it all into this heady stew of a book, down to him creating an improvised Iron Man armor in here. But I don't know, it's hard for me to hang on to Tony Stark or care about anybody or care about these situations or care about like boardroom shenanigans or anything like that, regardless of them being in hell or otherwise. That said, good art, good Belasco, good goopy hell going on as well.
Belasco, like Tabasco, spicy. Bring back Tony White Queen is all I would have to say. Not to be the Pete LePage of this podcast.
Green Arrow, number 19 from DC Comics, written by Chris Condon, art by Montos. Green Arrow is trying to track down a killer in Star City called the Freshwater Killer, and he gets closer than ever before this issue and finds out some surprising things about it. You know, we've been talking a lot about, over the course of this episode, decompression or not, and this issue is for the most part essentially like one long walk and talk between Green Arrow and this police detective. And it's great. Like, it moves so well across, even though it is this, for the most part, one back and forth conversation for the majority of the running time. But there's a propulsion to it. There's a snappiness to the patter that's going on here and the pace. And Montos keeps it constantly interesting, even when it's just them in a car or walking down a hallway or anything like that. Very impressed with this book so far.
Agree. The Montos art, you know, this has like some noir-y elements to it, and it's just hard from an artistic perspective to keep the noir-y, dark crime tone when you have a dude in like a goofy green outfit with a funny beard. And Montos does it. So shouts to that.
The Creeping Below, number 2 for Boob Studios, written by Brian Azzarello, art by Vanessa Del Rey. In the previous issue, a woman was taken by a Norse metal band, I believe, and killed and sacrificed and buried below a tree. And years later, she's woken up out of that tree, and her friend picks her up in her car, and they talk about it a bunch. Pretty wild book.
It is wild. I will say, though, this does a good job of just being metal. Like, this book, the art and the music and the story, you know, there's not a ton of twists and turns happening. It's a lot of, like, you're supposed to be dead. And everyone's like, But it is, the vibe is strong. It's a vibey comic.
I like this issue better than the first one. The first one felt relatively straightforward in terms of the, like, girl gets sucked in by evil band and killed, and she's coming back as a vengeful spirit. But most of this issue is like, no, we're not exactly going to do that. And then, spoiler, they do end up doing that, and that's okay. But, like, they have a dev team, like you're saying, to just sort of, like, sit in the vibes that it's fun and weird and intriguing. Mystique, number 3 from Marvel by Declan Shalvey. This issue, surprisingly, for a miniseries, is a crossover with Sentinels, number 3 as well, I believe, where Mystique is on a mission. She runs right into the Sentinels, and thanks to some juice it up from Fabian Cortez, actually gets the powers of Magneto when she looks like Magneto and battles the team. There's some more twists and turns here as Nick Fury continues to tighten the noose around her. Another great issue of this, beautifully drawn, propulsive action throughout. I really love this book. I'm really into it. And I love just picking up all of these details of X-Men lore, like Fabian Cortez showing up and praying to Magneto. I don't know. That's my jam, man.
That was cool. And I was like, right, that he was his lead acolyte back in the day. Like, that was such a great reminder, great use of that continuity. And yeah, I like this book as well. Good. The spy thriller aspect is the part that keeps surprising me, because I did not expect that. And we're getting that as well as all this X-superhero action.
Yeah. Green Lantern Dark, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Werther Delera. I think we loved, if I remember correctly, the first issue of this, which had a world crowned in darkness and only Green Lantern could bring the light. But Green Lantern did not believe in herself. A young girl did believe in her, and ultimately they triumphed over Solomon Grundy. That's where we pick up in this issue, as a new town, New Camelot, if I remember correctly, needs their help from a very fairy tale style monster or monsters that are stealing their children in the night. I think we have a better sense, or at least I got a better sense, of how this title is going to work long term in this issue, as sort of like a fairy tale western traveling from town to town fighting monsters. And I love it. Like, it's very, like we said in the first issue, they're a team who have worked on Something is Killing the Children.
Yes, so. It's crazy how they brought this team over from Something is Killing the Children and created a story set in the DC Universe that is just like Something is Killing the Children, and then that is satisfying and good. But I'm like, if you like Something is Killing the Children, this is literally that again in an interesting way.
Yeah, it's great. And Werther Del Daria's art is gorgeous throughout here. Definitely check this out. Lawful, number 6 for Boom Studios. Excuse me. Written by Greg Pak. Art by Diego Galindo. At the end of the last issue, our main character Song was captured, but given a chance to look human and normal again. And that's what he's grappling with, is that he can rejoin society, but at a much lower level than he was at before, and is even more beholden to the state. I mean, if you couldn't tell from my description here, Greg Pak is playing with some big, very pointed, very current ideas here through the lens of fantasy. And I think it's just so smartly done.
Yeah, smartly done. And like this issue, I feel like we're setting up for some finale stuff, perhaps. Like we're getting toward what the point is. And it comes together so well in this issue, I thought. The building, the action, the thematic stuff. The emotional arcs of a bunch of the different characters all comes together in a heated point that I thought was great.
And last but not least, Moon Knight Fist of Khonshu, number 3 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Domenico Carbone. In this issue, the mission? What's the name? Midnight Mission. The house dies. They kill the house. I'm sorry. My favorite character, your favorite character.
I love
the house dies, and now the Moon Knight team is on the run.
How's your house doing, Alex? I know your house was sort of sick.
It has a cold, but everybody has a cold this time of year, you know?
Especially there's
it's
a house.
It's kind of gross when a house sneezes, though.
Yeah, it's terrifying. So scary.
Boards and nails everywhere. It's gross.
Yeah, of course, boards are house snot.
You're a Jed McKay guy. What's going on in this book?
I don't know 100%, but I will say I really like Tigra, and I really like there's something here I like. But I don't know. When they were like, the house is dead, the house should be talking to us right now, I was like, what? I don't remember that. And I've read every issue of this. And they're very upset that the house isn't there to talk to them. And the house then goes back to an older version of the house. The house helped them out before the house died. I was like, how did the house die? How does the house live? Answer these questions, Jed, I say. There's certainly a status quo being built for Moon Knight, where we have Moon Knight, you got your 8-Balls, they're a fun, weird guy, some other people sort of in the Khonshu family, and Tigra. Hank Pym is playing a factor here. So I do like a lot of the path we're on, but we're still, there's still some hedges.
Yeah, it's weird. The thing that's bothering me is too strong, because this is fine. This is fine superhero books. But we start in a place where it's like, okay, back to status quo. He's fighting a new drug called, I think it was called Bliss, that's like fairy dust on the streets. Cool. And then we're 3 issues in, they're talking about talking houses and going to underground things that tie back to the Moon Knight run from 2014. And I'm like, this is too much, man. You cleaned it up and then you dirtied it up again, so that I am confused. So I hope we can go back to that main storyline, because I am really rooting for this book.
Yeah.
Same. And folks, that is it for our Christmas stack. Presents away, all done. Clean up the wrapping paper. And if you'd like to support us and all of our presents, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m., except over the holidays, to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We'd love to talk to you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club on Blue Sky, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok, Instagram, and Threads, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Happy New Year, unless we do another podcast, and then I'll see you then.
They fail at that special guest speak.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.